Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show with your morning show co-hosts, me, Julie Calamine, and Phil Huff. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, Julie.
How have you been?
It's been really good. What's not to like about this fabulous fall weather? Sunny, relatively warm?
No kidding. Sunny and finally the fall weather we've been waiting for. And with that segue, I'll just talk about weather for a moment and then on to our morning show, which is going to be a really good one. So today, folks, look for one of those wonderful late fall days. Mostly sunny, calm, and a high around 50. Does it get any better, Phil?
No.
Mm-mm. No. And tomorrow the same. However, today there is an air stagnation advisory. So still winds and folks are out burning those slash piles. So if you're going to do something athletic, you might want to check and make sure that's settled down before you do a marathon or something.
Well, it sure sounds like fall.
It does. It's our fall time.
And speaking of fall, it's the first Tuesday in November. And so it's election day. Almost everywhere there's something to vote on. Get out and vote for the candidates or issue of your choice, or your voice won't be heard.
That's right. We have in the city, we have city council elections, we have a mayoral election, and out in the outlying regions, we've got school districts.
Yeah, several cities have the city votes going on, and we've got school districts and board of education trustees here locally. Other places that might be listening to us have their own set of issues. Oftentimes, those are on the November ballot.
That's right. So even though there's nothing statewide, it's an important day to get out and vote. So please do that, everyone. All right. And then the rest of the week, we've got kind of sunny skies, lows in the 20s, some clouds coming at the end of the week, but nothing too earth-shattering. Yeah. It's going to be a good week.
Well, we're going to have a great show this morning. It's that time of year. The seasons are changing, so a lot of things come to the forefront. Some of us think it's the end of the fishing season, midway, beginning of the hunting season, and we're here as we do each fall with some folks from Idaho Fishing Game, but this is a real special pleasure today. We welcome back to the show, often guest Tom Whalen, now retired. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Phil.
Welcome and congratulations on your retirement, Tom.
Thank you, Julie.
And we're here with, can't exactly say no one can replace Tom, but we're here with the current set of enforcement or conservation officers for our region, Josh Stanley, the district conservation officer, and Dustin Mason, the senior conservation officer for our area. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
And that was Josh, and we want to hear voices.
And I'm Dustin.
Very
thanks for
good.
Having me.
Did it take two of them to replace one of you, Tom?
Just a half.
Well, we're here, as Phil has already said, just to talk about what's happening with fishing game, with conservation, with enforcement in this fall season, that season finishing up fishing and beginning hunting and sort of midway through hunting. And we're going to start, though, by talking with basically with Tom about what's it feeling like? What is it like to be finished and no longer out there checking on licenses, making sure people are behaving? How's it going?
Pretty darn good, actually. I mean, it was 31 years in the making, and actually 32 if you count the times I did work. Started as doing biology work, rowing on a river. Actually, we were electroshocking fish on the Bigwood River. And then that morphed into getting the opportunity to work with the enforcement branch, and that led to, you know, just what I can consider a great career. I was always made the point that this is the best job you'll never get paid that much for.
So tell us a little bit more about your career. And you've just touched on, I think, one of the things that a lot of people don't necessarily understand. There are different divisions of labor within the department. There are biologists and there are conservation officers. And
yeah, there's we have a lot of different branches. You know, we have lands, you know, managing all the wildlife management areas. We have the wildlife guys that, you know, most are familiar with. You know, that's who you would probably see at a lot of our public meetings. You know, that's where most of the people show up. Fisheries also, they show up for those meetings as well. So we have a lot of biologists. For us, for the Enforcement Bureau, we get into, you know, we do require a degree in wildlife. We actually have, you know, pretty large group of people. Overall, we're almost 1,000 people in the department. We are actually, when you just talk about officers, though, there's 83 that are statewide that are actually working. And we all have, if you think about that, it seems like maybe a lot, but there's more officers, I'm pretty sure, just in Coeur d'Alene.
And it is a big state, and it sounds like a lot of officers, but it really isn't. But going back to the education requirement, you know, you do need to know about wildlife, and you also have to know about enforcement. So do you all need 2 degrees? How do you come to this job? And then this will lead us into talking about all of your backgrounds, too.
Well, you know, we do require a Bachelor of Science degree, typically. So it's not always the case. Sometimes if somebody's had enough education, or enough field experience, I should say, they can come in through that direction as well. But it's highly competitive. You know, when you have like somebody like Dustin here, who's a lot newer than either Josh or I, although has been on for, I think it's what, 7 years now?
Just over five.
Okay, I'm sorry.
He's anyway, a newbie at 5 years.
He's still a newbie. Anyways, it turns out it's highly competitive. I know there's probably about, you know, for every 5 positions, we have about 400 plus people that apply.
Yeah. And 83. Boy, that actually doesn't sound like very many. I can envision 83 people out on the lake just doing what you do, and they would seem lost.
In a state our size, it's not many. And if you look at, like, for instance, some of our officers cover vast areas. On average, it's somewhere around probably 1,200 to 1,500 square miles per officer. But if you look at like some of the officers down in the Oahes, for instance, I think that's over above 3,000 square miles that they cover. It's larger in some states.
Wow. Well, let's just turn it around and reintroduce our two other guests and just hear about their backgrounds and how they came to be at Idaho Fish and Game. It's highly competitive, so let's hear about how y'all got here. Dustin, you're next to Tom, so I'm going to start with you. Dustin Mason.
All right, sounds good. Well, I came from Wisconsin originally, and I got a degree in wildlife management. My minor was in law enforcement, so that's how I kind of melded those things together. Always wanted to kind of do this job, so got a bunch of experience first. I worked for the National Park Service as a park ranger in North Cascades National Park, where I worked on a boat for about 3 years, and then saw that Fish and Game was hiring, and I applied, and just over five years ago, they decided to give me a try, and I spent about 5 of those years down in southern Idaho near Gidding, Idaho, where there's no trees and not very much water. And then after these guys start retiring like they do, they give us some opportunities for the young guys to come on up.
And you've touched on something I think that's interesting, too. The titles you have are somewhat generic: conservation officer, and the job has widespread responsibilities, and yet there is seemingly a focus. Most of the individuals in the department have some area of expertise or extra involvement. And you mentioned the lake.
Yeah, some more than others. Tom's position is a little more unique. My position now that we do focus on, I do focus on more fisheries stuff, but most of the officers across the state, they handle everything from game, fish, wildlife. They help with the habitat or any of the other biology work.
And what is your focus, Dustin?
My focus? I focus primarily on bull trout, native salmonids, and the Lake Pend Oreille drainage.
All right. So you have assumed Tom Whalen's position.
Yep.
Very good.
And he's doing a heck of a job.
Oh, good to hear it. All right. And Josh, tell us about your background, how you came to be here.
You bet. So I'm originally kind of from Bonner's Ferry, went to high school up there, and I was not the guy who, at an early age, knew I wanted to be a game warden. I just thought I needed to go to college because that's what everybody expected. So I went to the University of Idaho and graduated from there with a wildlife resources degree back in 2001, and shortly thereafter met my wife. And was doing some framing, working some fish and game jobs seasonally, which is a normal pattern for folks who are looking to get in this field, is to get some seasonal work. And that's when I first started getting around the game wardens and looking at the work that they did and thought, you know what, I think that's what I want to do. And so that's kind of when I really started focusing in on the work of a game warden.
Okay, and did you have any enforcement education, or were you able just to work your way into the position?
So, great question. So, really, when we're hiring people, we're not looking to hire, like, a cop who's already there. We will teach you how to be a law enforcement officer. So, if you have no law enforcement background, that's not the priority. We're looking for somebody that's more well-rounded, has the fish and wildlife background and education, and then we'll teach you how to be an investigator.
Yeah, because there's a high degree of education to the position from previous interviews with Tom and others. The last resort really is the enforcement, the stick.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we like to focus on the positive if we can. It's not always easy, but the reality is most of the people that who rely on us to do our job correctly, we rely on them to do it right as well, and that requires that connection with them to have their support, as well as us actually doing that job in the field. And the vast majority of people are just like that. You know, most of the people when we talk about hunters and fishermen, we're talking about sportsmen and sportswomen. And there's a long tradition there. And, you know, following the North American wildlife model, that's most people kind of somewhat take for granted. But we try to educate people how lucky you are to be here in this, in this country, to actually be able to, everybody shares that resource. All this wildlife doesn't belong to us. We're just mandated to help protect it and educate people about it. But this belongs to everybody.
And we could spend a whole hour talking about your background, your history, your experiences, but digging down into some of the most pertinent ones, what's changed about the job over the years?
Oh, it's, a lot hasn't. Still fundamentally, the job is the same as it probably was in the late 1800s. I mean, you go out, we're mandated or tasked. You know, as soon as they realized that wildlife needed to be protected and perpetuated and promoted, they started hiring. Initially, they hired game wardens through appointments through the governor's office. And then in 1938, that changed. And actually, a warden who was here when I first moved up here in 2000 was still alive then, a fellow named Les Gissel, and a lot of your listeners may remember him. Les was a wonderful guy, mid-90s when I met him, and he was hired in that first wave of officers that was hired on merit, on education, and on their background. And that was actually passed, it was mandated by the public because they were angry.
So it changed over from appointees to a more regulated system of hiring suitable enforcement officers.
Yeah, and that's where you start seeing, guys like Dustin here we look at, his background, his scholarship, his ability to have this science background melded or welded with an ability to actually be out in the field and doing programs like this, which are, highly educational, obviously.
That's right.
But so much has changed. We're not on horseback. we have patrol trucks and we have motorboats. And with that, there's all kinds of advancements in technology and a whole new skill set that's expected of an investigator today.
Let's go into that, because technology must have changed the role of game warden. Let's hear how it's changed.
For the good and the bad. So definitely as you guys see in your own lives, right? So are cell phones good or bad?
Yes.
Right? Right. It's not a yes or no answer. Yeah. Game wardens today are expected to be available at a moment's notice. And that's a very difficult expectation to meet. Because they still have the same area geographically that we had many years ago. We have not added hardly any positions to our ranks for many, many years, yet Idaho has continued to explode in population. Mm-hmm. So we have more people using the same resource. And so there are more calls for service, as we coined them in-house. And those things vary from, there's a bear climbing up onto my porch and it's in my bird feeder, which our officers in the panhandle deal with that a lot. And my little plug is go get bear aware if you're a landowner. How to deal with bears would help your game wardens a lot. Focus on real criminal investigative work that they would like to be focusing on. Now, hey, we're here to help and to serve. You call us, we're going to do our best to respond. But I will tell you that game wardens today are pulled in many, many directions and are probably a little, honestly, too available at times.
Right. And then there's the rise of social media, which is a whole new realm that some of them engage in, the department needs to engage in. And again, for good and bad, it can be a useful tool, but it can also be an extreme distraction.
Yeah. Yeah. Social media. For instance, we have a Conservation Officers Association in Idaho, and we have a Facebook page. we're independent of the Idaho Fishing Game. We actually have a magazine. You can follow us online at Idaho Conservation Officers Association and on our Facebook page.
And I'm looking at this magazine right now. It's very pretty. And I'm seeing a photo of a bunch of enforcement officers and some game that's been captured. It looks like a great publication.
Yeah, we'll talk about that case a little bit later in the hour.
It's the obvious extension of a shift beginning in the 1930s to a merit-based position. Now you have professionals, and like all professions, there's a society for it in a magazine. And
yeah, and social media is our friend. We have now a social media page through the department, Panhandle Facebook page, and statewide. We've posted information on there just to let the public know, you know, here's what we're busy doing in the field. We've actually posted information there on cases that we need help with. And people have actually given us tips. So social media can be a powerful tool.
Yes. Following down the line of technology, its helpfulness and harmfulness, you must have technology that you find helpful today. Things like DNA testing or maybe drones. Tell us more. Dustin, are you... What technology are you using on a day-to-day basis?
Jeez. I mean, I think the thing that we use the most is probably between our body cameras. We've got these things in our pockets that are called our cell phones, and we can do a lot with just what's in the phone, where you used to have to carry around a, you know, camera and a bunch of other equipment. And, you know, on our phones, sometimes we can actually check for licenses now if we have reception, which isn't very easy in northern Idaho. You have a lot of areas that don't seem to have reception. So just having that real quick at your fingertips, the DNA stuff has been great. I wasn't working at the time when that wasn't a thing, so I'm not sure, you know, how much the differences are there, but Tom could talk to that.
That really hurt.
That was Tom.
I will say the technology has changed, and it's always like it's a catch-up game. There's always somebody doing something really stupid sometimes that is maybe based on some technology. For instance, we've had reports in the past that I'm not aware of it here, but, you know, people hunting with drones, for instance, that's a whole new thing. And so people, we've had to, you know, slowly play this catch-up game, if you will.
They're like searching out game with drones and then to find it?
Right.
That's not very fair.
It's not.
That's why it's illegal.
Illegal. But, you know, we've always played this catch-up game. I would still maintain, though, the work is still in the woods. It still does involve the occasional drinking muddy water and sleeping in a hollow log type, attitude, and spending some days in the field. And it's still, because that's where the action is. The work's, as one of our former game wardens, Jerry, used to say, the work is in the woods. And so that's where we like to go.
And that's a good point to make. The area, the field that you're talking about is really broad. It's not just lands managed by Idaho Fish and Game. It's lands managed by really any of the land management agencies. Fish and Game is managing the wildlife.
Right. Our mandate actually is for all wildlife in the state. And, of course, a lot of wildlife doesn't know private property boundaries. They don't care. You know, they go everywhere. So they occur on public and on private ground. And they're migratory. So they're, you know, going to other countries as well. You know, we just have a mandate to preserve and protect wildlife that are in our state. So that's inclusive of the state.
So you're allowed to go on all of the lands, the private,
no,
BLM?
The wildlife is.
Oh, but you're not. Oh.
That gets a little trickier. We do, you know, we have a mandate to protect wildlife, even though it occurs on private. And we've certainly... work with a lot of private landowners also in some of the programs we do to manage for wildlife. So there's a lot of very positive things people can do and get tax incentives and things like that to do positive things for wildlife.
Mm-hmm. But the area you're concerned with are public lands.
All lands.
Right.
Anywhere wildlife goes and they could be harvested or fished for, we need to be able to go there to inspect that take is lawful.
Mm-hmm. And so in our area, when we're talking about particularly fisheries, dealing with your counterparts in other states, Montana, Washington, even British Columbia, perhaps, provinces. How often are you engaged with others?
A lot. Okay. Yeah. We actually, Josh mentioned the warden groups that are there. That actually occurs mm-hmm. in every state and province and other countries. And so we actually mm-hmm. have some of those meetings. The Idaho game wardens will meet with in these conferences and share information. But we actually share information just on casework. I know I've worked the moose case. It was actually in Canada one time when I had a trainee just a couple years back, and we ended up helping the Canadians realize we had an Idaho hunter had gone into Canada. And anyway, it turns out that we do a lot of cross-border meetings.
And there's resources available to us. So you think back, each game warden's got his own slice of Idaho that we have a patrol area that he's assigned to, he or she is assigned to. And when things are just very, very complicated in that there might be animals crossing state lines, it's a large investigation, there's a lot of moving parts to it. We actually have investigators that we can call on and assist that will help and coordinate with other state investigators. And we have seven of those, one for each region. And they make some unbelievable cases. There's the illegal commercialization of wildlife. That criminal activity is second only to illegal drugs in our country. Commercialization of wildlife, illegal mm-hmm. commercialization, is a big problem.
While we're talking about partnerships and collaborations, I suppose it would be valuable to also bring in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the tribal wildlife officials. And you must collaborate with both of those as well.
Yeah, this time of year, we actually just did collaborate with U.S. Fish and Wildlife officers up on the Canadian border. They mm-hmm. came up and ran a waterfowl check station and a game animal check station. It's surprising how many people from the U.S. are going to Canada to hunt waterfowl and mule deer. And our officers locally, Matt Haig, our Sandpoint officer, is also equipped with a canine, Hudson, and they have attended that check station to assist U.S. Fish and Wildlife at the border.
They're going, for the most part, legally to Canada.
Absolutely.
But in some cases not, and that's where you all get brought in.
Yeah, making sure that the game that they're bringing is in the condition that's required to bring it into the state.
Mm-hmm. I see.
We'll touch on another topic later in the hour on like CWD, chronic wasting disease, mm-hmm. and there are some new requirements if you're hunting certain provinces and states that you must do with your animal before bringing it into Idaho.
Well, we have a lot more to discuss, such as those CWP stations and turning in poachers. It's called CAP, C-A-P here in Idaho. But first, we're going to take a short music break and then come back to the a little more to the local scene and what's happening here in the Panhandle. So, per a request from Tom Whalen, we're going to be playing one of our favorite songs in the fish and game fish portion, and it's by the Whiz Pops. It's called the Bull Trout Song. And Tom, you know a little bit about its origination, don't you? Then we'll play it.
Well, help to try to drive the idea initially. Just Reg Crawford, who worked for TU, found a great band over in Montana, and we had the idea just to do a education song, part of that thing that we do, and it came out great. I think you'll enjoy it.
So now you can add songwriter to your resume.
That's
right.
I can add director.
All right. Well, here it goes. It's the Whiz Pops with the Bull Trout Song. Yes, this is KRFY 88.5 FM, listener-supported commercial radio for the Idaho Panhandle. This is Julie Calamine, your Tuesday morning show host, and I'm here with Phil Huff.
Yes, and if you're just tuning in, you can always listen to a podcast of the show later on at krfy.org. This morning we have retired Idaho Fish and Game Conservation Officer Tom Whalen talking a little bit about his career. We also have current folks working in conservation with Idaho Fish and Game, Josh Stanley and Dustin Mason, talking about the segue to the work it is today. Some of it's ongoing and similar, and some of it's changed a little bit. But one of the things that's really emerging in our region and in the West is chronic wasting disease. And incidents have been discovered in Montana, not far away. So we thought we should turn to that topic a little bit as it's being dealt with in Idaho in hopes that we don't find it here.
Yeah, this is Josh. So we're going to talk about chronic wasting disease for a little bit. Idaho Fish and Game is putting out a lot of information. If you want more, go to our website. and you can read a whole lot about chronic wasting disease. But our conversation here today, we're kind of referencing a little resource that the Fish and Game is publishing, a little trifold, kind of just a short rundown on what chronic wasting disease is, some new regulations that are associated with the import of animals from states that might be on the list of states that are known to be infected with chronic wasting disease.
So for those of us who haven't heard about chronic wasting disease, and I hope that's not very many people, what is it?
Chronic wasting disease, it's the deer form of mad cow disease. Some are calling it the zombie deer disease. It's not a good thing. What it is, it's a neurological disease that deer, elk, moose, and reindeer can get. It's documented in several Canadian provinces, as well as Montana, Utah, Wyoming, which are all, you know, British Columbia. Those are bordering Idaho, and that's why we're on kind of high alert, anticipating that we will get chronic wasting disease.
And it's moved west, right? Because I know it was in Minnesota, Dakotas, I think, and of course Montana.
Yeah, so it's kind of funny when you look at the map historically of where this has resided. British Columbia, Colorado, for several decades, and a little bit through the Dakotas, but not much. There was these two big populations in British Columbia and Colorado area. And for some reason, maybe it's hunters transporting dead things around the state as we go and hunt deer in Colorado, or a Montana hunter does that. That's part of the issue, is transportation of carcasses, specifically the brain and the spinal column and fluids. That's where this prion of chronic wasting is associated.
All right, and hence the education program so that we humans aren't spreading it into our own state.
Exactly, yes.
Tell us more about the stations and what they're doing.
So Idaho adopted, I think it's a couple of years ago, some new requirements that hunters have, that if they're transporting animals that they've harvested from other states into Idaho, there's some things you have to do. The animal has to be cut and wrapped. Meat can be imported that's cut and wrapped. The quarters need to be deboned. The bone needs to be taken out, and to include the brain and the spinal column.
So we're not bringing any bones or brains into the state.
Yes,
basically.
That's correct. Other things that are on here, would be like hides without heads. So you can bring a head in, but it has to be dried. So you have like maybe notch the skull cap and it's been dried, and then you can bring it into the state. But you can't cut the head off of a deer, elk, or moose and bring it in with the brain matter still in the head.
Which could be a problem for folks that might want to taxidermy something, right?
It is, and this is, yeah, this is a challenge. Even talking in the last couple weeks, we have taxidermists and meat processors locally that are just getting up to speed. And this is kind of... it's unfortunate because it's changing the way that they have to do business. And there is an inconvenience. I mean, if somebody shows up at your taxidermy shop with their trophy deer, and maybe it's from Libby, suddenly our taxidermists locally know that we have to take care of that, or you need to take it back right now, prep it, let it dry, and then bring it back.
And so how far back does that go? What if that head was taxidermied, I think that's the correct use of the verb, 2 decades ago, is it still a threat?
It's not a threat. And so even if we were to harvest something today, as long as we could get it dried out, get the brain matter out, leave the spinal column wherever, you know, it was shot, and get the skull dry, that kills the prion. Mm-hmm.
And so this effort, of course, is to make sure we don't import the disease here to Idaho, but there are also voluntary report stations for deer harvested in Idaho. Tell us a little bit about that and the efforts and the goals there.
There are. I'm aware that the Sandpoint Fish Hatchery has a drop station. I know that there's others locally, and I apologize, I don't remember exactly where those drop stations are. I think it's online. You guys remember?
Yeah. I'm sure we can find it online.
So you can drop your deer off, and we will send the sample off, and what we're collecting, if we get the whole head, we're collecting the lymph nodes, and then those are sent off to a lab, and we're going to test the lymph nodes to see if it has CWD. It's about a three-week approximate turnaround, and you'll be contacted, and it is voluntary. It's not a mandatory program, but you'll be contacted if your deer tested positive or not. For chronic wasting.
So that would be an advantage for a hunter if they were a bit concerned that their deer or moose
Absolutely.
Or elk
yeah, yeah.
might be infected.
And you can, it is voluntary again, and you can drop it off or you could send it to the lab yourself. And if you go on our website, there's information on how to do that.
Mm-hmm. But as a programmatic system, the hope too is to be able to detect early if there were any incidents.
Correct. And there is a protocol that's created that we would initiate if we were to detect chronic wasting disease in a population, let's say in the Kootenai Valley, which is bordering, you know, Libby, which is where this year there was 11, I think is the last number I've heard, deer that have tested positive in town in Libby. That's very concerning for us because everywhere chronic wasting disease has been documented, it has affected the population of ungulates. And reduce them.
Mm-hmm. And the threat to the ungulate population clearly is a threat to the values that we hold here for our wildlife. Is there a threat to human health?
So the Center for Disease Control has not had any documented transfer of chronic wasting disease to people, yet they do say don't eat an animal infected with chronic wasting disease.
We just don't know.
Yes.
We don't know, so best to be careful.
So this is a obviously a somewhat emergent local issue, but it's not the only thing that defines the work in this region. Let's talk a little bit about the uniqueness of the Panhandle.
From my, Dustin touched on this earlier coming from Southern Idaho, but, you know, what do we have a lot of? We have a lot of water in the Panhandle, and that's just absolutely awesome. So from a game warden's perspective up here, so much opportunity to do upland terrestrial work, but then jump on a boat and between Priest Lake, the Ponderay River, Kootenai River, Lake Ponderay, and all the lowland lakes in addition. That's very unique, and it's a mixed bag. It's in my opinion, the best place to be a game warden in Idaho is in the Panhandle.
And it very much makes your job a year-round job. And how do you balance the work with game animals versus fisheries? It's got to be kind of tough.
It does get a little difficult, especially in the fall. Most folks expect us to be up on the hill in the mountains, and that's honestly one of the reasons that Tom's previous position, my position, exists to kind of keep me down trekking on some fish while the majority of us are running around up in the mountains trying to check some deer and elk hunters. It depends officer to officer where they see the need. So if they feel that there's a lot of folks up this particular drainage or if they've had a lot of reports of violations in a certain area, it's just that's what a game warden does. They just have to decide and go to where they feel the need is.
So let's talk a little bit about the seasonal cycle and what areas you might be focusing on at different times of the year.
Yeah, so other officers in Idaho today are kind of winding down. Their seasons are coming to an end. They've got some controlled hunt season still, some late depredation hunts. But for us in the Panhandle, it's getting ramped up. The next 3 weeks is go time for us. Unit 1 is one of the largest units in Idaho. So north of all the country, north of the Ponderay River and Lake Ponderay to Canada between Washington and Montana is Unit 1. Unit 1 is going to kill, according to statistics last year, about 3,600 deer. There's not a unit in Idaho that kills that will have that high of high of harvest. So we are going to be very busy in the next few weeks.
So is that because it's a large unit, we have a lot of deer, or the hunters are really good?
I don't know, Phil. What do you think?
Yeah. Probably a little bit of all three.
We have a lot of deer, no doubt. Look at it. We have an extra doe tag. So you can get your regular deer tag and an extra doe tag.
And it's not just whitetails, though. You could find a mule deer in the Panhandle.
You could. So mule deer harvest is legal started November 1st for, answer is, bucks only. So we do protect mule deer does from harvest in the Panhandle.
And then once the ungulate season's dying down, the cat season comes on, right?
Wolf trapping will be going full speed. Houndsmen will be chasing lions. Trappers are coming out to, you know, trap other critters.
And you, of course, enforce trapping too. So it really is year round. When you're not working with fishing folks and hunting folks, you're working with the trapping folks.
And of course, there was always just one really bad week in like April. nobody went out.
and of course, we will think of, when we think of the lakes, we will think of fishing, but there's also waterfowl.
Yes.
That are abundant here, more so than certain parts of the state. In fact, one of our listeners sends in a question. Ask them how they can catch scofflaws that take the plug out of their gun when shooting waterfowl.
So if we were to watch somebody shoot more than three rounds out of their gun from their blind or from their bush where they're hunting, that's giving me probable cause to then talk to them and inspect their weapon.
And we've been talking about game animal enforcement, hunting enforcement, but are you also responsible for the non-game animals in the state? So you would have to see that folks aren't harming them.
Absolutely. So it's our mission is to preserve and protect all wildlife in the state of Idaho. And the majority of the funding we know comes from fishermen and deer and elk hunters. And that's okay, because a lot of the work that we do for deer and elk and for fish benefit the non-game species, the species we don't hunt.
And back to those scofflaws for a moment, Phil. There's a system for folks noticing people behaving illegally, and tell us about that.
It's called the Citizens Against Poaching Hotline. A lot of folks will ask me where they can find that number, and it's just on the back of your hunting or fishing license. If you just flip it over, a lot of people don't recognize that it's back there. But
and if they don't have a license, do we know it by heart, or do they just go online and find it?
You could go online and find it.
Mm-hmm. But it is 1-800-632-5999.
Yeah. Very good.
It's very good.
And it's a very, very important issue and question, but really it's a very small percentage of people, right?
Absolutely. So we know that the majority of the folks, and this is what we love about our job. So we're, as officers, we're passionate about the resource. And how awesome is when we go to work and we get to talk to other people all day long who are passionate about the resource, and that only a small percentage of them are actually violating. And in addition to that, a lot of those that are violating are what we call ignorant violators. They just didn't know what the rule was. They didn't intentionally go do wrong. And then you have some opportunistic folks who are good folks, and under the right situation, they might bend the rules. And then the ones that we really like catching are our intentional violators.
Yeah.
They left the house with a rifle and a spotlight to go poach.
And
we had just that this week. I mean, those things are continually happening all around our area.
And with that, nice segue from you, Josh, let's talk about a few of them, because I was online and there are some really kind of interesting online videos of what happens when those folks are out and you do find them and catch them, and some ways that you do that. Saw one with some elk in it. Shall we start with that?
So I didn't watch the video online, but is it a decoy?
Yes,
decoy
it operation? Is, the whole okay. Decoying operation.
So we run decoy operations in the Panhandle. They're very successful. In fact, Dustin, in his patrol area, when he was the Priest River officer for a few months, last fall, Dustin, you want to talk about one of the decoys that we ran?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, you just find a location that you've had problems with in the past, and then we have these decoys. We call them artificial simulated animals or wildlife. And you take them to location and you set them up and they look very realistic. Folks driving around, generally, again, folks that are intending to do so because they've got their spotlight and their rifle in hand, and they drive by. This particular one was at night. A gentleman from Washington was driving home or driving back to camp, I don't recall which, and headlights caught the animal in his headlights, and he took out the spotlight, and after a few seconds decided to be a good idea to shoot it. So
wow.
If I remember right, he like repositioned his vehicle in the road.
Oh, he took a nice long time thinking about it.
Scanned the neighboring area for neighbors to make sure nobody was around, and then pow. Mm.
Well, it's great that you were able to try and catch those folks, because they're likely not people that have never done that before. So it's
one thing about the decoys that's probably good to clarify with the public is that This is not some form of entrapment when you put a decoy out. It's actually, it's just, you know, there's an opportunity for the person to do the right thing as well. Mm-hmm. We've been on a lot of these. I've actually seen people stop and start throwing rocks at the deer and yelling at them, like, get out of here. Don't you know they're going to shoot you?
Yeah. And we're like, so please move on. You're going to spoil our set. Get out of here.
So we should talk a little bit about the education work that you also do year round to hopefully try to prevent situations like this.
So let me, let's talk about that part of the education is with like knowing what do you do when you see a violation? Okay. That's, so the best piece of information you can get is a license plate. We get vehicle descriptions that had muddy tires and it didn't, you know, had this or that. Oh man, there's so many trucks, pickup trucks. So it's like the best piece you can get is a license plate for us. And then you call the CAP hotline, which is awesome because we really got things working well. Idaho State Police is now dispatching all of our CAP calls. It was a third-party system in Nevada a few years ago, and those people didn't live in Idaho. They didn't know kind of maybe always the right questions to ask. They did good, but State Police is way better. Mm-hmm.
Now, is there dispatching them, or are they dispatching them all to conservation officers or other law enforcement agencies getting involved?
So when a call comes in, the citizen calls the 1-800 number, 1-800-632-5999. They're calling State Police, and a State Police dispatcher is going to answer the phone and ask you some questions. Who are you? What are you seeing? What's your location? And then they are going to dispatch that call to the right officer based upon a patrol area map. And they're doing that for all of Idaho.
Very good. And, you know, back to the license plate issue and getting that number. Boy, your cell phone with its magnifying lens is a great way to get a license plate. So
absolutely.
That's one way to do it.
I encourage folks all the time, don't ever be confrontational with a violator. You do not know what their mental ability is or what their intent is. So just get the information with the photograph. Call the CAP hotline, forward the photo to the CAP folks, and then we're going to get it. And what's awesome is when that call goes out, for instance, in the panhandle, every game warden in the panhandle sees the call in Sandpoint. And so if somebody's out of reception, they're up at Trout Creek on patrol, and they don't have cell phone coverage, the supervisor and maybe two or three other officers are going to see that.
So that's that's educational for the public who are wanting to help with the CAP program, but you do a lot of other education, young hunter safety training. Let's talk about some of the other education that happens.
Yeah, one big thing that we do, just as we talked with the Idaho Conservation Officer Association, we do have a week-long program where we teach kids down in Cascade, a large week-long hunter education field trip, which is real fun for all those kids that get to go there. Obviously, day-to-day type of things, we do have hunter education we go to. Myself, I follow behind Tom here, where he did a lot of the trout and native salmonid bull trout education work at Trestle Creek or the Waterlife Discovery Center and inside the classrooms. So we try to get the word out about fish identification so folks don't make that violation mistake in the future, and in all the hunter education classes, make sure they understand all the rules before they even begin.
And in addition to the standard hunter ed, we have now trapper ed. And so we're teaching trappers in Idaho, how to trap ethically, how to trap and follow, the rules. We don't want to really be catching things that we aren't targeting that can cause us problems.
Pets are a big one.
Yes.
That's a bad one.
That's right. And what's awesome is, there are some very, very seasoned and experienced trappers in our area who are very passionate about their sport, who are wanting to pass on that legacy of doing it the right way to new trappers. Because trapping can be something that, if you don't have a mentor, things can go wrong really quick. You catch somebody's dog and it dies. That's a horrible experience for everybody. And it's a black mark on trappers. So we want to provide educational opportunities on how to train trappers as well. We have an awesome women's hunting clinic that we've hosted. Julie Leninger, our officer out of St. Mary's, travels up here, and we've hosted it at the Kootenai National Wildlife Refuge several years and at Farragut State Park. It's always well attended. And if you're a woman and you're a hunter and you want more education, check out the women's hunting clinic.
And along lines of encouraging a more diverse population in Idaho hunting, I noticed that the youth hunting season was a little different this year. They were able to get out a bit earlier in the warmer weather. That's true.
So there's many, many opportunities that youth have that are unique intentionally. So yes, for instance, there's a youth waterfowl season where they're out a little bit earlier than everybody else. The youth turkey season, they're out a weekend earlier. If you're a seasoned elk hunter, you know that you've got to choose an A or a B tag. Well, kids get to hunt both seasons just with either tag. So many, many youth opportunities because we're about getting the next generation out there hunting because sportsmen are the one historically that have paid for the management of fish and wildlife, and the sale of license dollars is what funds our agency. We're not a general fund agency.
And when those youth actually shoot a deer, they have to know how to field dress it. And I understand there's a new way of kids learning about that. And this relates to technology. Who knows about that?
Yeah, I looked at it online. I guess on our fish and game website, the new AR, so they can use AR equipment, which I have never used myself yet to try to learn how to skin and clean a deer.
So they can start without getting their hands messy and then hopefully go on to the next step.
The kids always have a very interesting response when they see the videos of how to do it with a real animal. So, yeah, it's an interesting way to get them started.
So much more we could talk about. We're running a bit short on time, but I think it seems like, especially with this conversation about youth and all, we should finish on a really high note. Recent record was set on Lake Ponderay.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Tell us a little
bit
more.
Yeah, I saw it on
that.
Our webpage. Go to our website. So Idaho has this new catch and release record system, and we had a new rainbow trout caught and released on Lake Ponderay. I believe it was 36 and a half inches.
Yep. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, and by a young woman.
Yes, I think I don't know if it was her grandfather or I suspect it was a friend, but somebody was taking this girl out, which is like, that's a win in of itself. Yeah. When you're taking kids out fishing, hunting, thank you very much.
Well, you're all going to have, well, other than Tom, of course, you two were Josh and, Dustin and Josh, you are going to have a busy next 3 weeks. But when that's finished, are you going to get out and do a little hunting or fishing? Tell us.
Yes. Muzzleloader. I'm waiting on muzzleloader season.
Yeah, I think we all get out here and there in amongst the time that we're out working.
I'm even still stretching that fly rod. So,
you know, I can say the same, Tom. We'll have to talk at
now,
the end
probably.
Of the program. Well, I want to thank our three folks from Idaho Fish and Game, Tom Whalen, recently retired, Josh Stanley, Director of Enforcement, not Enforcement.
District Conservation Officer.
Thank you.
I don't have Director in my sights.
Okay, all right. And Dustin Mason, Senior Officer.
Thank you.
I want to thank you all for joining us this
thank
morning.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank Very you. Informative.
Thanks, guys.
Well, in honor of Tom's retirement, we're going to be playing a song request from him, and this is Nathaniel Ratliff and the Night Sweats with Hey Mama.